I sort of wanted to go through your career and talk a little bit about how you got started in this area, how companies like StarVision got started and morphed and all that. Sort of starting at the beginning, from what I read, you didn't really want to go in or intend to go into this area of technology. It was I read that you wanted to be a pilot. Is that right?
When I was a little kid, you know, yeah. 13 years old, mm-hmm. I went into air cadets and I had, you know, thoughts of being a pilot and loved the airplanes. And it just turned out I went to my physical for my mm-hmm. pilot's license. Mm-hmm. And the doctor told me, he said, "Son," he said, "you can never fly in the armed forces. You can never fly for a living. In fact," he said, "you are certified blind by our armed forces."
Really? Yeah.
So I had a big Coke bottle bottom, glasses, and you know, so I found out that wasn't going to be a career for me, right?
Right.
That doesn't mean I don't like flying. I can fly as a private pilot.
Right. So you got your private pilot license.
Well, I went through private pilots at university, and I ran out of money before I soloed. So that's an unfinished business that I'm actually going to take care of this year.
Oh, very
I'm going
good.
To go back. Yeah, I bought all the books and joined the ground school, and I'm going to take my license. So, but you know, when you're a kid, there's a lot of things you look at. I remember one other thing too that actually, when I look back, influenced me. When I was probably about 14 or 15, the Air Cadets took us for a trip to the General Motors plant in Oshawa.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a tour through the plant and watched how cars were made. And and that, more than anything, influenced me. I vowed right then I was going to run a company.
Right.
You know, a big company like that, or a company producing, creating something, right? So so that was interesting because... And I kept a poster of that. It was when we left the plant, they gave us a poster of a 1971 Corvette. And I still have that poster. And I bought a 1971 Corvette in 1980. But it's funny, I'd forgotten about that. And then when I started to put together companies, that's when I thought back and I thought, you know, I remember back then, I went to the library after I went to that General Motors plant, and I read every book you could read on building, how you build technology, like cars, airplanes, boats, you know, buildings, everything. So it really fascinated me, you know, all the technology and the creativity, and I guess... You know, I had forgotten about that, but that would more than anything influence me to want to build a company and create some kind of product, you know, and bring it to the world.
Right.
And and so when I got out of university, I actually had a degree in, electrical engineering with a sort of side degree in communications. One of the things at the end of my university, I picked up a book on data communications, and it was all about X25. And that fascinated me, the protocols, the handshakes, all the different, and so I got into that side of the business. That drove me sort of into data communications, and I started my career at Nortel in X25.
Right.
And
it was really the start of that sort of communication and the sort of ATM, the internet starting to emerge. All that was
That's right. That's right. And I sort of... I started as a hardware firmware developer in X25 on the Nortel X25 packet switch. It was called DPN, the DPN product line, digital packet network product line. And I designed some of the line system and both hardware and software for that. And that was pretty successful around the world because it was sold in Germany, Belgium, France, Switzerland, all over the U.S. So it was a pretty successful product. And as part of that, I ended up doing some standards work and in the world standards for data communication. So I went to study group 18 in Geneva and study group think it was Citigroup 15, 18, anyway, there was a number of them. Mm-hmm. And I put together a standard for some things that we wanted changed in the X25 for some products we were doing.
Right.
And I pushed that into the standards, and that's where I learned all about politics.
Right, yeah. Uh-huh.
Standards are probably six-tenths politics. Yeah. And
I guess that would be the ITU.
That was the ITU. It was called the CCITT at the time, right? Yes. It became the ITU.
The Blue Book.
Yeah, so I remember as a young engineer, my first trip to Amsterdam, or to Geneva through Amsterdam, and I got introduced to a crazy side of life and saw what the rest of the world looked like, and went to this standards meeting at Siemens in Munich.
Mm-hmm.
That was the next meeting, I guess, Siemens in Munich, and real eye-opener. Anyway, the Nortel experience and getting into standards showed me how you progress something from an idea through to being a product, and you bound it and describe it. And so, and I carried on with that at Nortel. I created a standard for their data, their circuit switch called Data Path. I didn't create it, but I was part of that.
Right. Uh-huh.
And I created a thing that was similar to what AT&T had called Data Kit, but it was for the Northern Telecom product. And I went into the standards forums and put in a bunch of standards to standardize that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, ran into politics, but managed to get enough standardized that we could claim it was a standard. But that whole for me, that background gave me the fundamentals, and when you bring a product to market, just some of the things that you have to do and, in order to get it adopted by the industry.
Right, yeah. Good experience. And
yeah, and the reason I say that is one of the, one of the things I wanted to do in communication was see multimedia happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the merging of video, voice, data, image into a seamless communication system. And back when I started in 1980, it wasn't there. And X25 packet switching was, to me, was the most promising way to do this. And of course, along with X25, there was the whole Ethernet, the whole LAN standards that were just in their very infancy back then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it was sort of a, you know, for telecommunications, it was X25, or it was a packet switch protocol that would allow this. And so I started, into the packet switch protocols and looking at the next generation, which was ATM at the time, asynchronous transfer mode.
Yes.
And that was the only way you could get multimedia content through the communications network at the time.
Yeah.
Because, LAN protocols just weren't deterministic enough to allow you to put voice and video through them at the time.
Yes.
And so I sort of took on a personal push to push ATM and to push multimedia, and became part of the whole study group 18 activity and the ITU that was pushing that. Plus, I ran courses up at Simon Fraser University for all the BCTEL engineers on SONET and ATM, and I pushed within NPR the whole ATM standards and multimedia.
Right.
So you know.
It seems quite visionary that because I mean going back to the days of X25, it wasn't obvious that multimedia or that sort of convergence was going to happen. I mean, there's data and there's voice and they're all different.
Yeah, and you had to. I guess I had read a few books and you know people projecting that packet switching was the way to be able to interlace all the different forms of communication over a single communication network, and when ATM came around, I was part of the groups that were defining it and how it was worked and how we were going to set the cell structure up to be able to carry both circuit switched traffic as or deterministic traffic as well as non-deterministic traffic. So anyway, that was interesting. That was back in BNR when I did that.
Mm-hmm.
I was part of the standards forums. I was pushing that. And then when I came out to BC, I I naturally kept that going. Now, that was really my sort of passion at the time.
What was your motivation for coming over to BC?
Well, that was interesting. When I was 13 years old, my mom and dad took a vacation across the country with myself and my brother. And when I got to BC and saw the gorgeous Rockies and the city, and I just said, I'm going to live here someday. Mm-hmm. I just vowed to myself I was going to live here someday. Uh-huh. And when I was at BNR, I went to a study group meeting in Seoul, Korea. Mm-hmm. And the guy there, the head of BC Tel Engineering, was there, and he was just sort of saying to people, you know, we're looking for engineers. And I said, I'm your man, you know, what's available? And so he steered me to NPR, where they were doing interviewing for some positions.
Mm-hmm.
That never came together right then, but about 6 months later, I got a call from somebody at NPR, said, we're interested, and I came out for an interview, and
mm-hmm.
I took the job, quit BNR, sold my house, sold my property, right, and moved out here, and myself and my wife, and never looked back. And NPR was an amazing place.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a sandbox, I called it, for young engineers to try things, right? So
yes.
BC Tel was mandated by the government to provide a certain amount of funding for research and development,
mm-hmm.
in the form of NPR. And that gave young engineers with ideas a chance to
mm-hmm.
put together project plans, grab some of that money, and run with it in some kind of project. So
mm-hmm.
I think the first thing I did was a customer, how would you explain it? We went in and analyzed BC Tel's
mm-hmm.
customers for workflow.
Mm-hmm.
We did workflow analysis, and then we applied that to their communication structure to tell them which services out of BC Tel they needed and what would to make their business function mm-hmm. the best it could.
Right.
And that was back in 1988, we did that. And that group that I formed to do that was still going. But what I did was, again, I really was interested in multimedia, so I started a group that we put together a multimedia application the end terminal equipment for a multimedia network.
Okay. Right.
That was Ian Bardsley started it along with Daryl McLeod and Bell Barn.
Mm-hmm.
They built the transport network
mm-hmm.
and the signaling capability, and my team built the applications and the terminal equipment.
Okay. Right.
And so we had mm-hmm. it was based on raw fiber, and it was analog transmission over the fiber. And then on top of that, we put digital like protocols to do the handshakes and the control and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But with that transport system, we were then able to offer video conferencing,
mm-hmm.
Personal video communications. We combined that with LAN,
mm-hmm.
LAN service, a very low bit LAN service.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were able to do a multimedia terminal at the endpoints,
right,
but not really based on any world standard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a homegrown standard. But mm-hmm. that system was rolled out all over the province,
mm-hmm.
and by BC Tel, they did a phenomenal job. And you were able to do video conferences mm-hmm. from anywhere in the province with this system, and it was quite exciting.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, my sort of background of protocols, I wanted to see this type of thing on a world standard stage, and
mm-hmm.
so ATM again was now starting to mm-hmm. to move again, and there was a group in NPR headed up by Norm Dowse and George Lipsky.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it was George Lipsky who was heading it up, along with Pat Ogmanson,
right,
and I joined that group and helped define what the services would be. So
mm-hmm.
a LAN interconnect service, a video service, and a circuit switched emulation service.
Mm-hmm.
And that was based on my work in the standards and what I understood of what was
mm-hmm.
going on. And so I pushed for those three different services over the ATM LAN,
mm-hmm.
and pushed to have end terminal devices that would allow you to concentrate
mm-hmm.
those different those three different services at the endpoint.
Right. Uh-huh.
And this was unique. We were unique in the world doing this. Mm-hmm. And we sold that ATM gear all over the world. We mm-hmm. sold it in Japan and Korea and mm-hmm. and again in Belgium and mm-hmm. France and in British Telecom and mm-hmm. it was. It was all new, and everybody was using it to really explore what they could mm-hmm. do with ATM.
Mm-hmm.
But what we gave them was the ability to actually put services in and charge right. for them. And yeah. so mm-hmm. The first company, I think, was Williams Telecom,
mm-hmm.
that bought our system to put in a network yeah. of ATM for LAN interconnect mm-hmm. service. And also Sun Microsystems put together a private network
mm-hmm.
using this. And I remember how that got started. I was at a standards meeting again over in Paris, or in France, mm-hmm. at yes. in Bordeaux. Uh-huh. And I was down in a cellar in a chateau, and we were having a yeah. meal with the mm-hmm. study group, whatever, I think it was study group 18 again.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran into the number 7 employee of Sun Microsystems. His mm-hmm. name's Tom Lyons. Mm-hmm. And I was telling him about our ATM system that we had created, and he just thought it was fantastic, and he wanted to, and they purchased, they spec'd it out and purchased the system and mm-hmm. used it for internal and for exploratory work.
Interesting.
So that got us going. That was the first sale really, and got us mm-hmm. going. And then Williams Telecom came after that, and then mm-hmm. there was a bunch of others, and then I was selling all over the world. We were mm-hmm. answering RFPs and RFIs and putting out brochures, and I was going and talking at standards meetings.
So was that as NPR?
That was at NPR, yeah. part of NPR.
So I always thought of NPR as a R&D facility rather.
It was, but again, if you had the desire to turn it into a sellable product, and this point in time, this was near the end of NPR now, because mm-hmm. it was 1992, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of push on to productize the things that we were doing and show a monetary value of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the regulatory environment was changing,
mm-hmm.
and NPR wanted to make sure they had a future. And so we were looking forward at not just right. research and development, mm-hmm. but also mm-hmm. turning some of this into products that, mm-hmm. that were had value. And so, you know, that was very exciting. George and myself and Pat Augmundson and Norm Dowds, you know, we within NPR we hatched this and worked mm-hmm. hard to get it underway.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we were at a trade show in Saskatoon, of all mm-hmm. places, I think. And Newbridge had a booth there.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over to the Newbridge booth, and I talked to a guy named Mike, I can't remember his last name, but he was the head of sales for the U.S., for Newbridge U.S., and I suggested to him that he really should come and have a look at this product, mm-hmm. because it was something that Newbridge really needed, and we had created it already, mm-hmm. and they should have a look at maybe rebadging it or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that led to eventually NPR selling the rights to this off to Newbridge. And I joined Newbridge as part of this, and George mm-hmm. Lipsky joined Newbridge. And we mm-hmm. became their ATM group at Newbridge.
Mm-hmm.
They already had an ATM group, but we sort of merged in with them and mm-hmm. drove ATM throughout the organization. So
mm-hmm.
first year or so, that's what I did, was I drove this ATM product throughout, all over the world, throughout Newbridge, and
mm-hmm.
traveled everywhere, educated them, mm-hmm. Showed them all the selling pitches and all the literature and the,
yeah.
you know, and then back at the ranch, I was the ATM product manager, managing the manufacturing and the demand from the field and the feature design.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite exciting. But again, my passion was always to start things. And so within Newbridge, I started a sort of ATM applications group.
Mm-hmm.
So we took the raw ATM and the capabilities we had created, and we turned it into, I did a demonstration of medical imaging a medical imaging service on ATM for Terry and for the executive at Newbridge. And Terry loved it, said, this is fantastic stuff. But he said, it doesn't really fit. Newbridge's, you know, we're a transport company.
Yeah.
And he said, so, I mean, if you're, if you want to start a company, I will help you get it going. And that was fantastic. And so Terry helped me get this off the ground and get it going. And I'll never forget the day Terry brought in all his top-level executives and sat around a table, and he pointed at each one and he said, okay, Peter's starting a company. He says, I'm in for X, whatever it was. I don't really like to say it. He says, how much are you putting in? He'd point at one of them and say, how much are you putting in? And and the person, I guess so. You know, they name a number, right? He said, Terry, that's kind of cheap. You know, you're worth millions. What are you talking about? You know? Anyway, around that table, we raised about $2 million. This to get me going. Yeah. So that was phenomenal. I mean, Terry was fantastic. And he helped so many, you know, young engineers get going like that.
Yeah,
maybe not that way, but anyway, it was quite exciting. So
that was the start of StarVision.
And George Lipsky and I started it. It was headquartered here. We started off in the Newbridge building, just by the boot, by BCTEL, and then moved it over to Metro Tower when it started to grow, and then moved it over to Still Creek Drive when it it started to really flourish. And it did fairly well. I mean, you know, sales first year were a few hundred K, second year were $1.5 million, third year $3.5-4 million. So it did pretty well.
Yeah.
But then the problem with it was not based on the internet. It was based on ATM, and the whole world just went internet within a few years, and if it wasn't internet, people just weren't interested, and so we got caught in that, and the sales dropped off, and we had to make a decision whether or not to redo the whole product to work on the LAN, or, you know, morph the company into something different, So we had been at it for about, I guess by that time, 4 years or so, I didn't want to see it just disappear, so I took the helm and we refocused it into voice over the network, voice over IP product. And it's still similar, though. It's a very multimedia, media processor, it's called. So it does the processing of video and image and voice in the network for services like voicemail or video conference or audio or video conferencing and things like that. So so anyway, we refocused it and grew the company.
So why the name change? Was it
fresh start? You want a fresh start, you know? And it was a completely different target market. So you wanted a fresh start and a fresh name.
Yeah, you got a fresh injection of capital.
Yes, Terry again. He came through with his personal finance company, his investment company, not Celtic House, but his other one that's based in Wales. And not just him. There was also Ontario Teachers Pension Plan Fund. There was money from, I think, Greg Gason put money in, personal money. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it was a good group of investors that said, like, we believe you can, you know, take this into the market. And what we did in StarVision, though, was actually, it was pretty exciting. And, you know, there's a huge push on right now by Cisco. And when you look at their advertising, they're doing exactly the same services that we were doing 10 years ago at StarVision, based on ATM. Now they're basing it, now it's based on IP, but same thing, you know, high quality video conferencing. That's one of their huge pushes in Cisco right now, medical distance education and telemedicine, and it's the same push. So we were probably just ahead of the game, and we had the wrong protocol.
Just talking about that protocol. I remember back in those days there was it seemed like there was a standards battle going on between ATM and IP, and
mm-hmm.
there were advocates on both sides. Basically, the telecom people were advocating the ATM, and the networking people advocating IP. And
mm-hmm.
It wasn't clear that IP was going to be the winner because
no.
the delays and the packets and
right.
all that. So what do you think happened there?
What happened was both sides they eventually morphed IP to be a lot like ATM. So they had to make IP be able to be more deterministic to carry the voice and video traffic. And
mm-hmm.
and ATM as well had created protocols that allowed you to be more like a data protocol. So it's funny how they both sort of came to closer together.
Right.
But the big draw with IP was the fact that you could go right from the desktop right through the network. And
mm-hmm.
ATM was never ever meant to be a desktop, to be an in-building protocol. It could
mm-hmm.
do it,
right.
but it could never get the efficiency that mm-hmm. IP could get, Ethernet could get within
right.
the building.
Yes.
And so it was doomed. I won't say I fought it, but I warned people many times that not to try to take ATM to the desktop, because it just was not designed for that. It just was not efficient enough,
yeah.
right? And efficient, by efficient, I mean the cost of the chipsets, the cost of the interfaces. It was never designed for that. It was designed for wide area network protocols, where you build very expensive networks, and then they're built to carry huge amounts of traffic and have as minimum delay and minimum error as possible. And so when people tried to move it into the desktop, they were doomed to never making that successful. But the good news was that IP, we were able to use IP. And I'm not religious about technology. ATM was the right thing at the time and had the right promise, but IP can do this. So with enough bandwidth, you can use almost any protocol.
Yeah,
so
right.
So anyway, IP is what we're all using.
Yes, I mean, IP is not efficient for carrying voice because of the protocol overheads and
right.
so on. It's,
right.
Yeah, so it's not perfect, but
it can do it.
It can do it, yeah.
When you have tons of bandwidth,
mm-hmm.
efficiencies aren't that important, so.
Yeah. So basically StarVision sort of morphed into NVIDIA, and the product got refinanced and redeveloped. So what happened to, there's some, I guess, changes. George Lipsky moved out and Grant Henderson moved in. Is that?
Well, Grant was already there. I hired Grant when I was at Newbridge, and I was doing this multimedia application group on ATM,
so
and Grant
was always part of that.
Yes, he was always part of it. He was an expert in multimedia at the University of Ottawa. He was
mm-hmm.
employed by Stentor, who was a long distance company in Canada, but he was working at the University of Ottawa on multimedia protocols
mm-hmm.
and applications. So
mm-hmm.
I pulled him into Newbridge back in 1994, I think, and then he joined StarVision and helped us drive that, and then he took on a more senior role when we moved into
mm-hmm.
into NVIDIA.
Mm-hmm.
And George departed. I mean, George had done a great job of driving StarVision and growing it. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, by that time it was almost 5 years, and I think, he wanted to move on to other things.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
And for me, I had never run a company, and I decided it was time. So. Time for
going
me to
going
do
back
it.
To that vision you had as a child.
Of yeah, that's right.
Corvette factory, I guess.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So then I guess NVIDIA started to grow, and
mm-hmm.
you now had the right product for the market, and
mm-hmm.
plain sailing from there, or were there hiccups on the way?
Well, yeah, I mean, we started the company right at when the bubble burst in telecom. So it was, I remember we went for our big round of financing, and we closed it on September 11th, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, because of that, it got delayed, but at least we closed it. We closed it on the 13th, I think, or 14th. But,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of companies lost their financing. Because when that happened, venture
mm-hmm.
capitalists pulled the plug.
Yeah.
We stuck with it. We took the money. We hunkered down. We were told by our VCs that it was going to be probably a little while. We sort of thought 2 years. It ended up that the whole telecom sort of funk stuck around, I think, for more like 4 or 5 years. But we hunkered down, got the product done, got sales going and underway, kept adding to the features, and kept building a good customer base and building a team, and slowly built the sales and kept it building. And then when telecom started to pick up, that's things started to go well.
In the right place at the right time, in the right product.
Absolutely. But because of that, I mean, it took a lot longer to bring this to market, really, than a startup usually took. I mean, the ATM product we did, it was probably 2 years, two and a half years from the start to the time that the market was exploding and people were looking for products and really getting hot market going. Whereas the Convedia side, the voice over IP side, it just never took off because the whole market, the telecom providers were still in a very bad financial position, right? None of them were, a lot of them had negative cash flow, a lot of them, it was a terrible situation for them. And so they weren't spending money on new things. So what we did was we saw this happening in North America and Europe, we went over to Asia where things were still exploding. Mainly because they were moving the whole country from a 1960s network system into a 21st century network system, and we were able to ride that as they moved quickly, and they sort of leapfrogged, jumped over a lot of the technology the West had used, and jumped right into huge IP networks, like Cisco made. Many billions of dollars, probably $10-20 billion on China and Asia, putting in monstrous IP networks all over the countries and the provinces, and so it was only a natural, we believe, that they would be looking for these services earlier than people in the West were. And that's what seemed to happen, is they started into getting voice onto their network, multimedia applications, things like that. And that helped us in the early days offset the lack of revenue from the U.S. and Europe.
So was it always your intention, or I guess Terry Matthews' intention for it to have an exit strategy of a acquisition?
No, Terry is not an acquisition type guy. Mm-hmm. Terry prefers to build companies, take them public, and turn them into long-term companies. Mm-hmm. And that was my goal when I started Star Vision and then Convedia, was to do that. But, you've always got to look at the circumstances going on in the marketplace, mm-hmm. and say to yourself, what is the right thing to do at the time, right? And with the telecom a lot slower than people thought, and with voice over IP growing a lot slower than everyone thought, it's take another few years before you would see it at the stage where it would grow fast enough to take the company public. And because there are certain metrics that you need to make to take the company public. And unfortunately, to do that, you're going to have to pump more money into it. You're going to have to dilute the shareholders even more to get to that point. And so we made a decision that we needed to look at what the possibilities were, and we still considered should we take it public, should we keep it private and keep putting money into it, should we get acquired, should we merge with companies, should we buy other companies. We looked at all the different things, but in truth, at the time when this happened, we weren't actually looking. We were actually still just in the mode of building this company and pushing it forward. But what happened was some offers came in. And that sort of triggered us then to say, oh, hold on, maybe we should look at what the options are. And so that's when we looked at the options and decided, maybe we'll get a banker and scope out what's going on out there. Because we had, I think, three companies had come in unsolicited looking at the technology. And, and we felt if that was going to happen, we really should do it right and get a banker and find out what the value was and who's really interested. So, and we were lucky. One of the things when we got our financing, we got Mayfield Ventures out of California. It was probably number six VC in the U.S. Mm-hmm. and six or eight or something. But anyway, one of the top 10. So. They were well connected, and when we started this, they brought in, Merrill Lynch. So mm-hmm. I mean, you know, as a small Canadian company, it would have been tough for us to get Merrill Lynch to do a market survey for us. But mm-hmm. but with the connections of a Mayfield, we were able to do that.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't go shopping Convidia around.
No.
It was a case of the product was, I guess, so good. The business was so promising that they came looking for you.
Yeah, and the sales were growing. We were the de facto standard.
Mm-hmm.
And when people talked about media servers in IP, mm-hmm. it was Convidia. And that was our goal at the start, was to be the number one and to mm-hmm. To be the reference.
Mm-hmm.
And being the reference, you're also the target. But mm-hmm. but at least we were the company to beat, and we had the features, and we were the one that looked the most professional. There were three companies. I remember when we brought this product to the first trade show, September 2002, I guess, because it was a year after the Trade Center disaster. There were three companies. One was based in Boston called Snowshore Networks. One was based in California called IP Unity.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, out of Canada. So there were three of us that came to the same trade show with the same mm-hmm. idea and products in various stages. Mm-hmm. We were and I remember we all talked to each other and compared notes and everything. Well, we got the product to market fastest. And that was probably because we had a jump start from the StarVision products.
Right.
So we took, and we didn't actually take the hardware. Well, we did for our beta version. We used a lot of the hardware that we'd used to StarVision.
Mm-hmm.
And then we redid it for the IP stuff. But at least that gave us a jump on everybody in the market. Right. So we were out first.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually targeted the right things in the marketplace, whereas some of our competitors, I think, went down rat holes that mm-hmm. they couldn't get out of.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I attributed that to the quality of our engineers here in BC.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. The work ethic right. and the quality.
Mm-hmm.
Second to none.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you, I'm starting another company now,
mm-hmm.
and it will be based here. The engineering will be done here because... I've done engineering in India and I've done it in China,
right.
but the quality stuff will be done here in Vancouver because, it is, and it's true.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that was, and so I attribute the fact we beat our competitors to the fact that we had quality engineering here.
Mm-hmm.
We had excellent sales guy, Dave Smith. He's David Smith. Mm-hmm. He's at Radisys still, but...
Mm-hmm.
He built our sales from nothing. He cold called hundreds and hundreds of telecom companies and got our sales going. Also, Sam Gu, our Asia guy, just tireless, spent 6 months of the year in Asia, just the one day short of legally having to become dual reporting and everything. But I mean, just amazing sales guys. And then also, Grant being able to understand in the market. Grant was phenomenal at casing out the market, figuring out where the market's going, which features are coming up, which target markets we should aim at. So it was a combination of excellent people and really good, hard-nosed engineers working mm-hmm. on it that did everything right.
Yeah.
Right, you can take shortcuts when you're doing stuff
mm-hmm.
in software and hardware, but it bites you in the end. And our guys did things the right way,
mm-hmm.
as fast as they could, but high quality, it pays off.
Excellent. what are the lessons that you sort of take away from the experience?
The whole experience? Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things you learn is that the market is what the market is, and to a certain extent, you can move the market a little bit, So you know, by the use of targeting analysts and educating them, and working with bankers and educating them, and then maybe going to standards forums and promoting certain things, you can move the market a little bit. But the market is tough to change, right? You have to be a Steve Jobs or somebody like that to really make the market make a change. So you've got to move with it. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to flow with the market, and you've got to adapt to it, and you've got to adjust your company and your products to match what's going on at a macro view, mm-hmm. right? Because you just can't control when a trade center gets destroyed or, you know, things like that, right? But you have to adapt to it. So that was one important thing. And I guess another thing, perseverance, you know, stick with what you believe in and what you know is right, mm-hmm. and keep working at it and working on it and try different ways to make it happen and never give up on it. And, mm-hmm. you know,
I heard that said about several people who have had an idea and they've hit rejection time and time again, but they keep on persevering and mm-hmm. eventually win out.
Right.
Many examples of that, and I've read the same about you. It's
right. Yeah, we had a big poster on our kitchen wall, and it said persistence. Persistence is the only thing that has solved mankind's problems throughout the ages, right? Mm-hmm. It's not smart brain power. It's not, you know, there's millions of smart people that never go anywhere. It's not, you know, anyway, it goes through all the things that it's not. It says persistence is the thing that makes mm-hmm. success happen in the world, right?
Yeah.
And so anyway, that was sort of a motto, and I guess we had to live by that because the telecom market was so bad.
Yeah.
You know, we had to persist. But, mm-hmm. Other things to learn, I mean, people are, you know, just so critical. Mm-hmm. Getting good people around you. Mm-hmm. I'm not a genius, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm a smart guy maybe, but I'm not a genius. But getting smart people with you, mm-hmm. people that have the same work ethic, mm-hmm. the same ability to work and put their egos aside, right? Mm-hmm. That's so important when you're building a company, because if you get a room full of egos, you're just never going to get anywhere. So all of us, although, you know, we're all driven people, and we all could put that aside and we could work together. We could argue things, but at the end of the day, we'd decide on something and stick to it. Mm-hmm. We'd all put our opinions out. We could voice our opinions, but you know, not hold a grudge on things when it didn't go the exact way we wanted. So, mm-hmm. so that was important to have people that are smart, but able to work together. Mm-hmm. And we worked really well together.
So I guess the question for that is how did you get those? How do you find those people?
Yeah, that's interesting, because when I look back on it, a lot of them were people I had hired and trusted from previous things, or people I had known from other things. So there were a few MPR people at Star Vision. There were quite a few MPR people at Convedia, less so, but still key people from MPR.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Grant, who I'd hired at Newbridge. And then it's funny, you know, people pointed out to me afterward that a lot of the people I hired are a lot like me. Mm. You know, maybe that's a truth. Maybe mm-hmm. when you hire people, yeah. unconsciously you look for people that are mm-hmm. like yourself. And I tend to be, I guess, you know, hardworking. I put a lot of hours in. Mm-hmm. You know, I try to work with people. I've mm-hmm. never tried to be a dictator.
Mm-hmm.
But you also, as a leader, you have to accept the responsibility and mm-hmm. make decisions when they're needed. But mm-hmm. yeah, and so anyway, a lot of the people I guess I had around me were like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess in a startup, that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it sort of helps if that sort of working ethic is there, that everyone sort of
mm-hmm.
Contributes similarly. But I guess there are other models as well. Often people say you should hire people who are not like you.
So, mm-hmm.
it's,
so you get different
you
ideas.
Skills, yes. And, yes. Yeah.
And that could, yeah. you know, maybe Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. And I also have learned that companies go through phases. Mm-hmm. You know, in the early phases, it takes a certain activities and structure, and then as it gets bigger, it has to morph into something different, and it's sort of is the up to 1 million, the 1 to 10 million, and then the 10 million, and we were only up to like 30. So, but it had to change at each one of those boundaries mm-hmm. in order to function properly.
Yeah.
You couldn't run it the same way you ran it as a 5-person startup. It just never worked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we talked a little bit about the lessons that you learned. Would you say there were any personal qualities that you have that helped in the success, the work ethic you talked about?
I think enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. You've got to be, you're the leader. It's your idea. Right. These people. Essentially, you've assembled a team of people to take your idea and make it happen, right? That's what you're doing. And so you've got to have that enthusiasm and that and project that to people and never lose that. Because I found that in the company as I went, the company also. So if I was down and if I projected that, it would ripple through. And so you had to be very careful that you kept your own personal ups and downs kind of mass so that people didn't reflect that in the company. So you have to be enthusiastic and you have to have vision. I always have vision of where things are going and where you're taking it. I always found you have to be honest with the people. You have to tell them what's happening, the goods and the bads. If it's not going well, you tell them it's not going well, and here's what we're going to do to fix it. If anybody's got ideas, tell me. But this is what I'm planning to do to fix it, and I found that really helped. People were never felt they were in the dark. I mean, sometimes I must say, when things got heavy, then you didn't communicate enough, and that was something that I sometimes was guilty of. Is maybe it went 6 months before I had another all-employee meeting, whereas I was trying to do them at least once a quarter.
Yeah.
But communicating with all the people is so important to keep everyone in the know. So everybody, I guess the whole thing about it is, with a small group of people, everybody has to be pulling in the same direction and understand where you're going, so that they're not wasting cycles on things that won't help you, help you succeed. So.
So you're on to a new project now. You're taking a bit of a break.
I took a year off.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's been that long.
Pardon?
It has been that long.
No, I started January 1st this year. But it's turned out I already have another company underway. I have, mm-hmm. again, it's people that I've worked with in the past that I trust. But I have one guy on contract, and we have about 6 employees under subcontract.
Mm-hmm.
And we should have a prototype out by mid-year, and I can't say what it is yet.
Right. Yeah.
But it's really exciting. Mm-hmm. Everybody's excited about it, and
mm-hmm.
can hardly wait to hatch it.
So, is your intention for the next business to take it public, or are you looking for another?
You have to, when you start a company, you have to build it with the intent to take it public. I mean, you've got to do that, because if you don't do that, then it's a sham. And you're always, what you need to do is say, I'm building this to be a multi-billion-dollar company, and I believe that in my mind, and that's where I'm going. Now, if things come along the way, opportunities or twists and turns, you should look at them. But you should always, start with the intent to build this into a multi-billion-dollar worldwide successful venture. I believe that. I don't think you should buy it as a flip or build it as a flip.
Yes.
I don't think you should.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think you're kidding yourself. I think, there's a lot of scam artists in the world, mm-hmm. and I've seen many on the VSE. I've seen them, that's just another form of scam artists, I think. Mm-hmm. I think if you want, but that's me, right? Mm-hmm. That's what I am. I like to create things and build them and make them successful that way.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the money isn't, I'm not doing this just to make millions and millions of dollars of myself so I can drive, go around and drive the latest car and live in a huge mansion. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I can do that out of this, sure, I'm happy. I love it, right?
Right,
but really, it's my and as I said to you about that GM thing, it's to create something and bring it to the world.
Right.
To me, that's the exciting thing, to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that through a group of people is, you know, it's amazing to be able to do that. Because you can't do it yourself. You can't possibly do a technology product all by yourself,
right?
Unless it's extremely simple, right? So you have to do it through a group of people, and that's where it becomes challenging, right?
Yeah. So are you funding this yourself? Do you
so far.
Is Terry...
No. So far it's me, my own money, and I will be starting to go out for investment probably in the next, you know, next 30 to 60 days.
Right.
But, you know, there's many different things, ways to fund things, and after going through the VC route, I think VCs are fantastic for big plays. What I want to do is try a play where I don't have to give up a lot of the company to bring it to market. So, and so I'm hoping this time I'll be able to do it with without venture capital money. Although if I need it, I'll use it definitely, because I had very good experience with our venture capitalists. I mean, you know, great people, great help. I mean, the only thing is that when people lend you lots of money, you give up lots of your value in, in the company. And so you don't want to do that unless you have to. We had to at Convedia because it took so long for the market to develop. You know, if I don't have to do that, I'd like to not, because then all the employees get more value out of this, right?
Yeah, I think there's a different economy in play, especially in sort of telecom internet businesses now than there was back in those days. You don't necessarily need as much money to get a business
started, right.
And you have, I mean, I often follow some of these companies where it's just two people. Google, we can take Google for as a good example of that, where it just becomes viral and explodes.
Yeah, with the net, you got to take advantage of the net. I mean, you have to if you're going to do something. I mean, Convedia and StarVision were both very hardware-centric, and doing telecom hardware is extremely expensive undertaking. And so you have to be able to get big amounts of capital to do that, and big amounts of capital come from venture capitalists. And so that's this product I'm doing now will not have a huge hardware component. There will be some hardware with it, but it won't be, it won't take that massive amount of capital that that Convedia and StarVision did.
So you talk about how great I guess the people are in BC, and you're going to stay here. I just think about the young people coming out from college. I mean, starting where you were many years ago, what message would you convey to people just getting started, either in engineering or young entrepreneurs? Any encouraging words?
I think get a foundation in whatever area interests you, and all, you know, it's follow your heart and your head. Like, find something that you love doing that really excites you, really interests you, because if you have that, that'll help you through your whole career. When you hit the points where you have to make decisions on which way to go, if you have a, you know, some area that you're really interested in, or some vision that you'd really like to see happen, that helps you all along the way, right? And then you've got to get a foundation, a good foundation in whatever you're going to do. So, you know, my apprentice years were at Nortel, where I worked. You know, I worked 7 days a week, probably, you know, 16 hours a day or 14 hours a day at Nortel doing hardware development and firmware development. And you know, that sort of, if you pay those dues and you learn your trade, then you've got a good foundation then for the future when you're managing other people that are doing that. And you want to make sure you get the most out of it, because you will have to decide whether they're working hard enough or not hard enough, or when to crack the whip, when not to, when to reward people, Mm-hmm. You know, and if you don't understand how technology is created and developed, then mm-hmm. you'll make bad decisions, and they just, you know, mm-hmm. it won't help your cause. The other thing I did, and I didn't do this intentionally, but it turned out for the best, was I got a good foundation in all the different parts of building a technology company. So the manufacturing part, mm-hmm. the development part, the research part, the architecture side, the mm-hmm. systems architecture side. So yeah. Try not, you know, don't be unidimensional. You know, if you do, you know, software developments on say user interfaces your whole life, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know how you can ever branch out and become a full product, mm-hmm. you know, create a product that, you know, that has all the different aspects to it. Mm-hmm. You have to get some basis, some foundation in each area mm-hmm. to be able to manage a company.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, throughout my career, I've been a product manager, I've been a salesperson, I've been a marketing person, I've been, like I say, in manufacturing engineering,
right.
And then in pure R&D. So all the different sort of areas of taking a product through market.
Yeah.
And I think that's important.
You used the word apprenticeship, and you don't hear people talk in those terms. But I think you're right, it's getting that sort of breadth of exposure in lots of different areas. Yeah.
Absolutely. And some people don't need that. I mean, some of my classmates that came out of University of Waterloo, I think two or three of them went right into their own companies. And I think in their case, their parents had companies.
Yeah.
And so they understood, you know, how you did that, what the challenges were. And myself, my parents had not. And so, you know, when I got into this, it was, you know, there was nobody there to advise me on what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you have an idea and a vision of what you want to do, you know, starting a company early, I would say, is better than I waited, what was it, 10 years or 12, 15 years before I finally started, you know, and I, looking back, I probably could have started one 5 years out of university.
Mm-hmm.
I probably had enough grounding and knowledge and a vision of what I wanted to do to do it that early. And you know, and another thing people, I think, one of the things in Canada, I think people are too worried about failure. And in the States, a lot of people will, you know, they'll try a company and maybe it doesn't work out and then they morph onto something else. But they're not, it's not as much of a stigma that you didn't make it, right? So maybe if you're younger and you try something and it doesn't work out, well, you're a lot more, you don't have a huge mortgage, you don't have six kids or whatever, so you're able to roll with it a little easier, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true when I sort of look at where I'm in my stage of life, and you're more inclined to take risks when you're younger because you've got less to lose.
Less liability.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, it's just about 11, so we need to, I guess, wrap up. So is there anything I haven't talked about that we missed or...
Well, okay, let's talk a bit about high tech in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the problems I see in Vancouver is so many of our high tech companies are branch plants out of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm guilty of this too now, having sold off Convidia to Radisys, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that is in any downturn, they shed these branch plants.
Yeah.
Right? And there was a massive bloodbath when the last recession happened, and
mm-hmm.
you know, so many Vancouver companies went under.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're almost in Vancouver the way Silicon Valley was maybe 30 years ago, you know, or maybe 40 years ago, I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've got to get more anchor points,
mm-hmm.
more companies that have made it successful, that are growing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there aren't that many. You know, maybe EA, maybe McDonald Detweiler, although, you know, I'm hearing they're up for sale and now the government's blocking it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, PMC Sierra, Greg did a fantastic job of mm-hmm. growing that,
mm-hmm.
creating a very valuable company that's You know, it's, we need more of that, and we also need more people who've been through the cycle and have money now to invest in new things with young guys that are coming up, young people, men and women that are coming up, right? And we're just getting to that point where it's, you know, maybe we can start to see some of that second, third, fourth generation helping, right?
Yes. Yeah.
But it needs wealth, right? It's really the basis. Wealth creation has to happen, and then that gets reinvested back into the industry. Yeah. And we're still very early in that, I think. The government needs to, you know, do its thing. I mean, it can't be the government, but all of us, like myself, who have started companies and taken them through and maybe got some cash out of it, need to to try to get another set going to see if we can't hit the rim. Right. You know, like Waterloo hit the rim company, billions of dollars, right? Yeah. Extremely successful. That will create so many spin-offs in that area. We don't have a rim yet, right? PMC did well. EA is not really based here. It's you know, but, you know, so we need that.
A company that sort of has its base here and grows to be most billion dollar.
And then you need a few of those, right? You need one to get it going, and then, you know, when I'm dealing with Radistus down in Portland, I mean, Intel really drives their whole high tech scene down there.
Yeah.
It all started with the Intel plant that was there, and you know, Intel exploded, became extremely successful, and all sorts of spin-offs out of that. You know, Tektronix and all these companies that were ex-Intel people that were trying other things, right? Radisys is one of them, right? And
so how do you see that happening? What are the elements that are missing?
I think we just need a success. We need enough tries that one of them
grows up.
One of them hits the mother load and becomes an anchor for the whole rest of this high-tech community.
So you don't think it's the government's place?
The government, all the government can do is put in the right environment, right? Taxes, you know, training, retraining, you know, the things that the government can help control. They should try to do that. But do it really is up to us, the entrepreneurs that are in this, to take that next step. And the only way is if you have enough, you know, enough tries at it. It's statistical. Everything's statistical, right? Enough tries at it that one of them hits and becomes, you know, immensely successful.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've got to do that. So that's what I'm trying to do, is start another one. And
do you think it's, I guess, the attraction of the acquisition that doesn't allow any of these to get to that point? Because, you know, just...
But that's, again, that's part of building wealth, right? Because as you go through the cycle, you know, as a person, you work hard, you work long hours, you want to get something back out of it. So, and we all go through this, right? The first company or two, we probably don't have enough experience to take it to the nth level. We build it, we may sell it off, it may go public, but it's not, you know, it's not a world beater. But we get enough cash that we can then reinvest into something else, right? So you almost have to go through that cycle. But the key is not quitting there, right? The key is to go back into it, not just live on the laurels and maybe the money you got in the first one, but go back into it and start another one with the intent of finding something that's going to be that exploding one. And I think if we all do that in this industry, then we will hit that eventually, right? If we all just take the little money we got in the first round, or, you know, and then go and sit on a beach and in you know, wherever, Texada Island or something, that's a waste. You know, we've wasted the chances we got. So.
Yeah, I mean, when you look around, there have been quite a few of these small successes where companies have been acquired, and you've got Kodak, and you've got Don Detweiler, you've got Sierra Wireless, and I guess they've not been acquired, but you know, people have moved on and retired, and so you've got wealth. But just thinking about that, you've also got, in some of those cases, those people have left Canada because of the taxation issues.
Right.
And so they're sort of taking that wealth away from where it was.
I personally think that taxation is one of the biggest problems in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're so overtaxed in this country, and it kills initiative. When you go to any of the more rural towns, mm-hmm. how many people are on welfare, and how many, you know, because it's easier to get welfare than it is to get a real job, you know?
Right.
Uh-huh. And, you know, I think the government's got to reduce the tax load and let the people, you know, spend the money to create wealth, not the government trying to socially engineer things, right? Which never works. And
which comes back to the question of the role of the government, and is this the right environment to enable big companies to grow?
What, in BC, you mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it is from many points of view. I mean, the beautiful place to live, it attracts top talent. The closeness to the U.S. and the closeness to Asia.
Right.
You know, it's not close miles wise, but it's a single plane hop.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of cross culture between Asia and Canada. So
yeah.
those three things, and good universities here. I mean, UBC, SFU, UVic, all excellent universities. And
mm-hmm.
so there's a lot of good things. I think Canada in general has a problem with taxation. You know, we're a small country with lots of people in a huge space, and that means you got to pay a little more to get the services. But
mm-hmm.
I think the government's, they talk about surpluses, and to me, surpluses are just, that's the most ludicrous term I've ever heard of. When you're based on a tax base to make money,
right.
You don't have a surplus. You're just gouging the taxpayers, right? And
right.
And the government's got to get out of it and let people use the money to start things, you know, because the government is historically terrible at starting, making things happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
I got the financial records from the federal government for one taxation year and saw where all the money went.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably a third of the spending in this country goes to discretionary projects that throughout all the politicians' writings.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read what they are absolutely disgusting what they're funding, right? And it's buying votes. That's all it is.
Yeah.
That's a third of the funding. That money could be being, the people could be using that money to start initiatives, you know, enterprises, small businesses, you know, whatever, right? Rather than the politicians using it to buy votes in all their writings, which is all they're doing. That upsets me just because, it's a disadvantage. We are taxed more than Russians were taxed at the height of communism, right? Their black market was bigger than our free money, right? Which is disgusting, right? Oh, well.
So, I guess it's a big problem. one of the reasons I came to Canada from the UK was at the time the tax rate in the UK was
worse.
It was
terrible.
But I think I've not been back there for a little while. But the impression I get is over the last decade or so, there's been a lot of reform in the UK. It's not as bad as it used to be. And I think Canada's now worse.
I think Canada's worse.
Yeah.
Although I was surprised to see all the protests going on in the UK from teachers and. They're saying now they their standard of living has fallen so badly.
Yeah.
Now I don't know if that's taxation or if it's just goods cost.
I've not been close enough, but I know that they're going through a little bit of a financial crisis right now, just like in the U.S. Some of the banks needing to be bailed out because.
That I saw as a big problem in the UK when I went there is the price of housing is so expensive.
Oh, yeah.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. I mean, I still wouldn't move back there because you've got the... it's just so expensive to live.
Mm-hmm.
And the rule of thumb I have, I don't know if you've been there, but generally if you spend a dollar in Canada to buy the same thing.
It's a pound.
It's a pound.
Right. And it's the same number, but it's the same number. Different currency.
Yeah, and it's basically twice as much.
And that means, it's 2 to 2.5 times more expensive.
Yeah.
but the problem is that salaries aren't 2.5 times bigger.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which, it's tough.
I think we're very fortunate, lucky in living here in BC. It's a wonderful place.
Yeah, it is.
And if the government didn't tax